Hello and what's up, everybody? Welcome to the Wind Up Podcast. I am your host, Mike, of MTGA Wind, and today we are getting into, quote, was wine... Oh, shoot, I already screwed up. Ugh, I was feeling it. It was going to be such a good intro. Here it is. 3, 2, 1. And today we are getting into, was California's wine revolution just a mirage? I wish I could take credit for that tagline, because it is actually from an article back in late April from punchdrink.com and John McCarroll. It is all about kind of the California craft wine movement, where it is, and frankly, how challenging and poor it's going right now. It is something that I think we've kind of touched on, kind of the downturn of just Napa in general, the amount of business coming out our way, how tough it is for small producers to make it. This article certainly takes it one step further, talks to a few folks everywhere from here in California down to Santa Cruz. It relates it to Bordeaux and other wine regions on how small producers kind of operate, what our expenses are like, just about, you know, when it comes to the land and rentals and of equipment and facilities and things, and goes from there. There is a link to this article down in the description. Please give it a read. It is a very interesting, you know, perspective on, I think, where many of these small producers think the wine industry is going, the challenges that some of us are facing, and that's just the reality of it. And hopefully I can help kind of mold this in a way that's providing a way out for people, because this is something that honestly hits very close to home when you start with, you know, something like Merlot, like we did back in the day, when it's one of the least popular wines to work with, when people simply aren't buying it, when you're, you know, rubbing nickels together to try and pay your bills. That is something that hits very close to home. So this is going to be a fun article to kind of dive into with you all this week. Before we do that, just wanted to thank again everybody for sharing, downloading, subscribing to the show. Please make sure to continue to do so and share this with, you know, other wine fans and friends around the country. You can please, if you have a little bit of time, leave a little rating or review for the show. That really helps, again, kind of with the algorithm and getting everything out there. So wherever you're consuming your podcasts, many applications have that little like 5-star rating system where you can write a little review yourself. Please have at it. Also, be sure to follow us on all of our social networks. We're basically on everything except TikTok. So wherever you like consuming information, at MTGA Wines is where you're going to want to look. The two most prevalent ones for us are definitely YouTube, number one. It's where you can catch the recordings, video recordings of the show here, as well as tasting notes, seller updates, just kind of day-to-day operations of what it's really like to be in the wine industry in Napa. And two is going to be Instagram, where we all live vicariously through amazing photography and videography. So feel free to jump on board that. We try and post regularly there as well, with just seller updates, kind of what's going on, where we're at in the industry, and how things are going. So without any further ado, let's talk about kind of the wine revolution that they're alluding to in California. Now, this is something that I think small producers kind of always kind of take up the banner for, right? We see the big names in the room, your Silver Oaks, your Camuses, your Mayomis, your Prisoner Wine Companies, your Constellation Brands and Treasury Wine Estates, Gallo Family, whoever, whatever big corporate entity you're not a fan of, we automatically put them up against the wall and say, hey, we as small producers are the firing squad. Here is why we are doing things with more passion, with more, you know, honesty, and just making a better product overall. I totally stumbled over my words there. And it's tough in this world. In fact, shoot, who... Sea Smoke just got purchased, I believe, by Constellation Brands literally yesterday or the day before. So if you're listening to this on Wednesday, it would be May 15th, a couple of days ago, another brand was consolidated and kind of rolled on up into another one of these big corporations. And, you know, Sea Smoke makes a decent amount of wine. But what about those of us that are making a couple thousand cases, maybe a few thousand cases? What are we doing? You know, how are we operating within this new realm of the wine world, right? Where we are trying to kind of be the counterculture movement to what has become popular wine. And that's really kind of the basis of this California wine revolution, where things, you know, ramped up so quickly in the 1990s. You saw big companies and conglomerates start snapping up places here, there, and everywhere. You've seen more mergers and acquisitions, you know, in recent history over the last 20 years, and especially in the last couple of years, you're seeing a lot of big names get scooped up, like your Joseph Phelps of the world, like your Rombauers, like Sea Smoke. And then also you have small producers like Massakin or Schrader a few years back that are getting purchased. So you're seeing this consolidation up top, and you have this undercurrent, almost like craft breweries, right? Where you have kind of this undercurrent of small producers that want to make really high quality, really great stuff, and be kind of that counterculture movement to what has become this broad wine business and wine industry. For me, that's really what this, you know, revolution is about. And I don't think it is a mirage, you know, to kind of write it off as such, I think is incorrect. But this is where it really, if you're going to be the counterculture movement, you're not necessarily going to be popular in your first few years of production. You're not necessarily going to be popular in your first 10 years of production. You know, for us, you know, making wines that people frankly didn't really expect or want even, it took me 9 years to actually build a sustainable business where I could work for myself, because we were doing things that were just different. And that's okay. But you need to understand that, hey, if you're going to be that revolution and that counterculture movement, you might be a little bit ahead of the game. And frankly, there are going to be consumers that aren't ready for you yet. And that can be an issue. And I think that is something that is very, very prevalent within our wine industry. Now, let me show you kind of the article here. And I'm going to reference this as time goes on. So if you're watching, you know, apologies for the camera movement real quick, but just to show you, boop, 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 boop. Here we go. This is what to look for. I'll be sure, again, be sure to check out the link on this article, and we'll give you kind of all of the info. It'll give you all this kind of information and perspective on it, which I find very interesting and a great point of conversation. So, all right, let me reset that. Whoop, there we go. And let me bring the article right in front of me here. Perfect. So there are any number of places I could really start with this article. Number one, you have a lot of folks within the industry of from Monterio Cellars. You have Margins Wine and down in Santa Cruz. You have references to John Bonnet. I think that's how I always screw up the accent on his last name, and his book, The New California Wine. I mean, and I love this quote here, and it doesn't look like it says where it's from. I'm sure it's somewhere in here that I missed, but it's quite simple, right? That no bank is going to give small winemakers a loan. They know we're a bad investment, 100%. Small-time winemaking is not where you make a big return. So if you're looking to get in the wine business, it's probably easier to continue buying the wine that you love to drink rather than actually doing it yourself. Fair warning. I try to tell people that all the time. People don't listen. That's okay. You know, it seems to me that the article here, it really kind of leans on, you know, owning the land. And then there is kind of this, you know, advantage to, of course, owning your own farm, you know, managing it from top to bottom, and realistically having more control. You can also have the option of leasing some of that vineyard, selling some of that fruit, and that helps cover the costs of doing business. There are plenty of places that do this where they only use a portion of the fruit that they actually grow, and they sell the overwhelming majority of it because that's really what their cash cow is. It's like, hey, we can make the wine we want to make, and this is helping us pay the bills. That is obviously a big leg up for owning land. And here, this article definitely highlights that, you know, people don't necessarily think that that's a huge leg up, but it is an immense one, or at least it can be, depending on how you have structured things. Because farming is expensive. The upkeep is really, really expensive. It's really tough to do. If you're having to hire on, you know, a team to bring that in, vineyard management companies are more and more expensive every single year and not necessarily doing the best job. So you're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place some years as a farmer, especially if a natural disaster happens to hit. especially if you have what we would call these bumper crop years where you had a lot of fruit last year, you have a very low demand for fruit this year, and now you're stuck in between a rock and a hard place of like, hey, do we, pick these grapes ourselves and make wine? Do we try and sell it as bulk wine? Do we try and sell it ourselves? Like you do end up with these kind of tough decisions to make, even if you do own the land when it's all said and done. Now, they also bring in the, hey, it's not just about the vineyards and not being able to purchase this land and potentially have another revenue stream in the form of selling grapes or bulk juice, but it's also just, it's expensive to be out here. I don't think I need to remind everybody, depending on where you're at in the country, it's going to be more expensive to pay rent, in one place or another. The cost of production in Napa is going to be more expensive than other parts of California. And if you're going to focus on Napa and Napa Cabernet, guess what? Them is the ropes. That's where you're going to have to hang your hat. Even if you're renting from custom crush facilities, it's getting to the point where, and this is something that we're even considering, that it's getting expensive enough that it's almost worth going in with a couple of partners, finding a warehouse space and renting that out, and then splitting it up and having more of a collective kind of format, like roommates, back in college, like, hey, if we can split the rent, this is going to go a long way, versus everybody having their own individual custom crush places where, you're paying a lot of money. I mean, probably, t I mean, tens of thousands of dollars to be able to process your fruit, have it stored, aged, and everything there. And typically, you're not able to do the winemaking yourself. You're having to rely on someone else's team because legally they're supposed to do the work. So you submit work orders, they do the work for you, and typically it works out. Typically. They also touch on just the cost of doing business. And this shouldn't come as any surprise to many of you is that things have receded a little bit in terms of like the supply chain crisis we all experienced in, 2022. But costs really haven't gone down that much. Realistically, at that time, I mean, instantly, we saw a cost of the goods we were using in terms of like glass bottles, corks, shipping, and all kinds of other things were going up 30, 40%. And, we can't raise our prices that quickly. We're going to alienate our consumer base. We have to kind of mitigate that some way, shape, or form. Like us, we took some price increases to help deal with that. But I can tell you right now, if we had to raise, if we have a $100 bottle of wine and we needed to raise that 40%, and then, hey, here's the new price because this is what it is now, it's not going to work. There are a couple of places that may have tried, and some folks like us that were a little bit more conservative in our price increases. But, very typically, wineries are kind of stuck with, hey, we're just going to have to float these costs and do the best we can. It's why for some of us, like our margins may seem kind of high for people. And they're like, man, you guys actually make like a lot of money per bottle. It's like, well, yeah, we have to because we're already years in debt trying to get this started. We have years where things are only getting more expensive, like these supply chain things. We have down years where we don't make as much wine as we really want. And we have these operating costs that we have to take care of. So it's this weird game of like small volume, high margin, but low net profit when it's all said and done. It's very, man, there are plenty of financial people that could probably explain this way better than me, but it's just this weird system that you kind of have to game and be prepared for that is really tough to do. It's really, really tough to do. Now, and this is a great quote here. I really wish I could see, where this was coming from as well on the article. They didn't put it here somewhere. So we can never, and this quote is great, it's we can never reflect what the price should actually be on these wines. Our price points are really low considering how expensive wine is to make here. Looks like that was from Ashton Lewis, although I don't see what business they are associated with. And that's absolutely true. We actually, this is why we joke all the time with people. It's like, oh, don't get into the wine game because it's just not going to be worth it. The return on investment is typically very low. It is something where there are a lot of perks. There's a lot of lifestyle stuff that comes along with it. You're probably going to make a decent living if you can hold tight and kind of get through, tough years like we're having so far, or these kind of weird ebbs and flows of kind of the broader wine market and alcohol industry. But realistically, it's going to be a struggle every single year. you know, talking about some of our social networks, and particularly like an Instagram, where people are very much living vicariously through other people with great photos of food and wine and travel and all these things, it looks really nice. On the inside, we're screaming because we're like, how the hell are we going to get through this next phase of where wine consumption is going and what people are looking for? Now, this article seems to paint a fairly doom and gloom kind of, you know, outlook on where the industry is, how it's going, and are some of us small producers actually going to survive over the next year, 2 years, 3 years, whatever the case may be. It's interesting looking at some of the folks that were kind of quoted in this article. They are making a very eclectic range of wines. I mean, everything from Piquette, which kind of had a little tiny flash in the pan moment, but not really. You have everything from Sangiovese to Carmenere to just kind of these oddball reds and whites that just typically in the U.S. do not have the market share that, say, like Napa Cab does. They don't quite have the identity that, you know, a Sonoma Pinot Noir does. So when it comes to this kind of wine revolution and wondering whether or not it's a mirage, I don't think it's a mirage, but it's definitely a lot further off in the distance than what we were expecting. You know, I think there are many of us, you know, small producers in this industry that are looking and kind of waiting in the wings to say, hey, when are people going to wake up and, you know, understand that shopping in a lot of grocery stores and buying wine off those shelves is akin to going to a fast food restaurant. You're getting food technically, but is it actually good for you? Is it actually providing like some real sustenance, right? And if you're doing the same thing with wine, and I had this amazing question, you know, during the last week of travel of, hey, I typically get, you know, really bad headaches whenever I'm, you know, whenever I go to my local shop, I buy wine and I drink it, like it's kind of rough. And she listed the brands she was consuming. I'm like, oh, well, there's a lot of sugar in those wines, you know, so you're doubling down on being dehydrated between the alcohol that's high alcohol with a bunch of sugar in it. Yeah, this is going to probably give you a headache. And I was like, you probably realistically need to be drinking wines with less or low sugar content, and that's going to help at least a little bit, potentially lower alcohol content as well. And she's like, yeah, but I really love sweet wines. I'm like, well, then you're just going to have to kind of suffer through the headache. Like, sorry, I don't know what to tell you, but that them is the ropes, right? You know, it's, you have kind of these, this undercurrent of folks that are asking the right questions and they want to understand more about wine and realistically kind of what this craft wine revolution or whatever you want to call it means, because they're starting to understand that the big producers are doing things, you know, from a production standpoint and stylistically that they just don't necessarily align with anymore. You know, just because it has the big name and tends to be the Goliath in the room and is expensive and is, quote, highly rated and reviewed, that doesn't necessarily hold as much weight as it used to. So there is still this great undercurrent of people trying to move the needle for us small producers and get more and more people to understand, like, hey, yes, our wines are tougher to get a hold of. You typically have to be in a wine club. It means they're getting shipped out to you, which means you're probably paying a little extra because it's not just sitting on a retail shelf in front of you, but you're able to support people that actually can provide you all the information you want when it comes to the wine you're drinking, what actually goes into it and what that means and how it affects you and the beverage that you're consuming. That is the level of transparency that I think this revolution kind of has been needing. And it's something that more and more of us have been very vocal about. We're trying to explain to people like, hey, here's what actually goes on in these big cellars and with certain producers, and you should be aware of it. Because technically, legally, we do not have to disclose this information. And I'm a huge proponent that, you know, information is power and an informed consumer is a more powerful consumer. So you should be asking those questions. And if that winery won't answer you, is unwilling to, or you just can't get that information, that should be a red flag. Plain and simple. You know, it doesn't mean you have to drink natural wine, because all of you at this point know my opinion on natural wine, that it's mostly garbage. And there are some good stuff out there, but it's few and far between, which kind of sucks, because you're kind of, you're taking this revolution and you're, you know, multiplying it by 100 and saying, we need to go hard into this. This is the problem. Yes, but also no, you need to calm down. Let us actually, you know, bring people into this. Like, wine is intimidating enough. You don't need to alienate more people by telling them, hey, if you're not drinking natural wine, you're doing it wrong. And luckily, there's not a lot of people doing that. But there are a lot of hipsters in the natural wine world that would go that route, you know, because of just, they're like, oh, it's, you know, free of this and free of that and low SO2 and low alcohol and all these things. I'm like, well, that's not necessarily the issue here. Like, the issue is, when is this craft thing going to happen? When are people going to understand that wine is a manufactured, or can be a manufactured product, versus this kind of romantic craft beverage that everyone kind of assumes it is? You know, that us winemakers just gently caress grapes as they come into the winery, and cherubs flutter down and bless them and then flutter off, and wine is made. You know, it's not that. It hasn't been that for decades. It hasn't been that for centuries. It is a production. And at a certain point, those manufacturing practices kind of come into play. So this wine revolution is still happening, but it is truly the destination that we see is further off into the distance, right? It's like, hey, we're going to go on this hike. It's only going to be about 3 miles. Well, guess what? It's going to be closer to 6, you know, because we hung a left when we should have hung a right. And now it's going to take a longer time frame to get there. That's just the way it is. The reason I know that this revolution is still happening is because of the amount of people I talk to out on the road and in Napa. And I guess this is all anecdotal information, but everybody I talk to is looking for more information. They're looking for more transparency. They want to support small producers. They want places with great stories and authenticity to be what they're consuming. That is the number one thing that, I mean, every single person. When I say every single person, I mean every single person I talk to over the last year and a half and change. That's the kind of stuff they're looking for. It doesn't mean they're not going to go out and buy wine from the big names every once in a while, because you need your Tuesday night pizza wine, and sometimes you just need something good. It doesn't have to be great. You know, it is like, you know what? I'm on my way home from the airport yesterday. Literally, I'm like, I just want an In-N-Out burger. I've been in the Midwest for basically 3 weeks out of the last month. I'm going to go get an In-N-Out burger and a milkshake and just, you know, enjoy this for what it is. You know, that's totally fine. We all need that moment every once in a while. But there are more people more interested in supporting small craft places now than there ever have been. There are more people asking questions about, hey, what actually goes into winemaking? What is the difference between what we see in our local grocery store or liquor store versus what we get from you? Like, how is this different? Why is it different? And what does that mean for me, the consumer? This is something that we try to do. And I'm not sure about the other folks in this article, but I'm sure they're similar. If they're small producers and they are trying to build these brands, I'm assuming that this is the kind of stuff they're working on. For those that aren't really aware, the alcohol industry is a very relationship-based industry. It's a small industry. Everyone kind of knows everybody. And if you're going to act a fool, guess what? Everyone else is going to know it. So it behooves you to be a good person and shake hands and kiss babies and be nice about it. Because even if you don't have a particularly successful sales trip, when you get back and you lay into your distributor about that, that story is not staying with them, right? It's going to spread across other accounts and other sales reps and other people. You know, if you're at all shaking the boat in a bad way, everyone's going to know about it. Everyone's going to call you out on certain things. There's one person in this article that it was funny because one of them came up in just kind of casual conversation while we were out at a bar talking with a couple of colleagues of mine. And she was like, yeah, I've known this guy. I've known the restaurants where he's worked. There's been a lot of European wines he's promoted on his wine lists, but not a lot of California. Yet here he is kind of pretending to be this champion of California wine now. Like, what's the shift? Like, what happened? Like, you used to not do this at all. And now here you are. And I'm all about it because I'm like, hey, if you've changed your tune and you want to support local rather than what's coming from across the pond, have at it. Like, please do. But, please continue to walk the walk as well. It's okay to kind of shift that mentality over time and understand, like, hey, there's a lot of great wine coming from the US. We don't necessarily need to be consuming stuff coming from abroad, And that's a I'm a proponent of that. As much as I love drinking wines from Europe and other locales, it's like, hey, I do also want to drink a lot of local as well. I like having something different. I mean, the fridge behind me here, the big one, there's a shelf like right down there. There's one shelf that is like imports, stuff that's, places that we've either visited, where we've had friends work, and it's maybe a case of wine outside of that entire thing. And it's just enough to be like, hey, let's have some kind of fun stuff and support people we actually know and like, and kind of support again this like craft wine like revolution across the world. But everything else in that fridge back there, Napa. Maybe some Sonoma and Anderson Valley, but for the vast majority of it's Napa, baby, because that's where we are. It's the friends we want to support, the other businesses we want to support, and that's incredibly important to us. And that is something that is. It's that relationship. We know these people. We have relationships. We're friends with these people. And that's what we want. And that's what we try to convey to others within the wine drinking community, not just within the industry. But we try to say, hey, if we're coming out on the road, like I just got home from another trip to the Midwest, and there were, 20 or so people that we hosted for a wine tasting on Saturday afternoon. Big shout out to Carrie and Wes out in Kansas City. Appreciate you guys taking care of me, slinging some wine, and inviting people, everyone over to kind of go through it. It was an amazing, amazing tasting with a lot, again, kind of a lot of people asking the right questions. But it was one of those events where it's like, let me bring you into this world. Because there were a few people that were actual real wine fans there. There are a few people that like wine, but don't really know a lot about it and still feel intimidated by it. There were folks that work in the industry as well for restaurants and retail shops and wine bars. It was a really eclectic mix of people, which is awesome because we can kind of actually, it was great having some other industry people there because they kind of echoed a lot of what I was saying. We really were able to kind of be like, yeah, this is how it is from someone who's working in a wine bar to someone who's actually making it. This is how we all look at this and what we're looking for when it comes to this industry. It's what keeps us going. And that is building these relationships and getting to know people. We mentioned this a little bit in kind of the travel episode that we posted last week of kind of what makes, wine travel worth it. Is it the short-term pop in sales? Or are you looking for these long-term relationships? That way you have somebody, sharing your wine, not just with themselves and opening and drinking that bottle themselves, but sharing it with other people and doing that true kind of like grassroots style of marketing. That is an undercurrent that is still, it's still a strong current going through this industry. And I don't think it's going to slow down. Based on my experience and how often we have these conversations and the genuine interest of other people within the industry and even outside of it who just enjoy wine, like some of you who are listening to this, you want to know these things. You want to know that this wine is made honestly, that it's not just some marketing scheme, that this is an actual winemaker crafting this, not just some bulk juice product that could be coming from anywhere, anytime, any year, and it's manipulated to taste a certain way. We're looking for more authenticity in what we're consuming because there's so much bullshit out there. And that's the backlash that kind of the commercial wine scene is seeing. It's bleeding over into the craft wine scene as well because people just don't know which way is up. They don't know who to trust. And there needs to be a handful of us producers that actually start being like, hey, let's sit down at this table and get everything out there. So that way you have someone you can trust in this industry. That is something that I'm a huge proponent of. And that is where my belief kind of hangs with where this revolution is. And why I think it's further off in the distance is because there's inherently some skepticism. You know, we're the ones making and selling this wine. It behooves us to try and sell you on it. Why should you trust us when we're just going to hype ourselves up, right? Totally get it. You know, it's going to be one of those things where we have to convince you, hey, this is not like, you know, one size fits all here. There's going to be a lot of different ways to go about winemaking, a lot of different ways to be authentic or craft or whatever fun, you know, marketing buzz term you want to call this thing. But we want you to come to the table with us, share a glass of wine, and let's have an honest conversation about this. And let's try and bring you into our world a little bit so it's less intimidating, it's more interesting, and you find more value in what you're consuming and what you're purchasing from wineries. That is hugely important. Now, to dive into kind of, I think, where this article leans in terms of the financial challenges of the small wine business, that's stuff that I have gone on and on and on about, you know, between, you know, these low production but higher margins to try and keep us going versus playing the volume game of making tens of thousands of cases and only making a couple of bucks per bottle. But hey, you're making 100,000 bottles, so, you know, that's 200 grand net profit. Like, that's great. Like, we can talk about that all day, every day. You know, we can talk about the pricing of land and how advantageous it is to actually be able to own that land and have total control and sell some of that fruit off and have another revenue stream. We can talk about the challenges of rent and custom crush and how expensive it is to be in this industry. The overhead is not cheap. And as we know, it takes you a couple of years typically before you start selling anything. So you're really in debt. You know, I mean, within like 7 years, I was not making a lot of money. And then starting my own project and self-funding it, I was, this might not seem like a lot to some people, but for someone who's in his mid-20s and has $100,000 in debt, that was a lot. It was a big pill to swallow. And it was simply like, we have to hope that we can play catch up. That 100K I've invested into this wine business is eventually going to come to fruition in some way, and that we're going to see a return on that. And we're very lucky that that has been the case. But we were in the hole for a long time before we could ever kind of make that jump into doing this full time. That's very much because of those of you that listen to this, that we've been able to do that. It's a struggle. It's more of a struggle when you're making wines that people don't necessarily want. Having started with Merlot in 2010 and adding on Riesling in 2013, you couldn't pick two more unpopular wines to try and start a brand with. And I am not kidding. We joke about the sideways effect and how it affected Merlot sales. The amount of times I would go into a market, try and sell my wine to a restaurateur or a wine shop, they would say, hey, these wines are good. We can't sell them, so thanks for coming in. Because they're just not popular enough. No one wants to drink Merlot. Everyone thinks Riesling is sweet. And frankly, these price points are too high. They're not going to work. I was told no a lot. I was also told to fuck off quite a few times. Funny enough. Those stories are always fun when you have a retailer just lay into you like that. Whew. Luckily, that doesn't happen that often. But it did happen quite a bit in the early days. So you're already kind of up a creek without a paddle. And I don't want to bag on some of the producers that are featured in this article, but they're making a lot of stuff that's not trendy. You know, it's everything. I mean, shoot, you have some of these, they're oddball reds and whites. You have folks making Piquette and these like slightly sparkling wines. Like, it's not stuff that it's popular probably in Brooklyn and in LA, but it's not going to be in terms of like a broad market thing. You're going to have to really hustle to make a brand like that make sense. You know, it's something that, you know, and just kind of a light scan of some of the brands that are mentioned, and they make a lot of different wines. And I'm curious kind of like, where's the focus? I'm sure they have one. It's something that I'm going to dive into more just to kind of see where they're at, because if they're the ones kind of being quoted as like, hey, we're struggling and we're hurting and we're having a really hard time, I've been there, because we started with wines that were not popular, that people didn't want. And if you're kind of in that same boat and you're a couple years into this, yeah, that's going to be where you are. I appreciate the fact that you're doing these cool kind of off-brand varieties and styles. Great. Is there an actual market for it? Is there a niche that you've been able to carve out for yourself and continue this business? Or is it going to be a struggle for a while because you're just a little bit ahead of the curve and there are not a lot of early adopters willing to make that leap just yet into your natural wines or your Piquettes or these other varieties, you know? Because the vast majority of the wine drinking public kind of hangs their hat on a couple of things. And realistically, of the wine drinking public, there's like 1% that drink the overwhelming majority of wine. So, you know, there's the potential can seem really, really finite. And in years like this, and, you know, down years like this, and even last year as well for many, many people, where you're struggling already because you're kind of in startup mode still, you're seeing sales falter a little bit, and you are in a realm of products that there's not a huge demand for, you've got a lot lined up against you. Like I said, believe me, I know, I've been there. And sometimes it takes downsizing and reevaluating what you want to be doing and how you want to be doing it, what production size actually makes sense. And like myself, maybe you maintain that day job for an extra 5 or 6 years because you have to. You need that influx of cash. That 100K I mentioned that I invested in my own business, that came from my paychecks at work, right? Every disposable dollar, and I mean every disposable dollar I had over the course of 10 years went into trying to build a wine business, right? Investing, you know, on average, you know, 10K a year and saying like, hey, this is the money I can save up. Let's see if I can't like keep this moving forward while doing something else. That's how we had to operate. I didn't have a choice. I couldn't pay rent if I didn't do that. I needed to have a safety net in the form of another job to be able to fund this winemaking habit I had at the time. And it took that 10 years to finally get to a point where it's like, okay, we're at a production level. We have enough wine. If we sell X amount, this can actually be a fully fledged business. It doesn't have to be the hobby anymore. So we took that leap and here we are. And now we've had a couple of very good years, despite COVID, despite supply chain and the expense of being in this industry, we've made it through a really rocky period. And now we're on the precipice of another one where sales are dipping. Visitation to Napa is dipping. You know, distribution, even selling your wines around the country is tough right now. We have plenty of distributors that we've been in touch with in certain markets that are like, hey, we would love to bring your wines in, but we're on a total freeze. Like, we're not bringing in any new product because sales are down. Sales have been slow for about 18 months, if not a little bit longer. So everyone is pulling back a little bit. And you're having to really fight and grind to survive right now. That's how the small production industry works. Now, I can't speak for anyone in this article when it comes to their expectations, but you see this happen all the time. And I don't know if any of them are in this realm, but they see the popularity, or some people might see the popularity of the wine industry like, hey, this is a great, we can be a great small producer, make a few thousand cases, make a splash. And basically, once we get a foothold, we can just kind of print money. We're going to find this niche, we're going to carve it out, and it's going to be awesome. Best laid plans, right? This is going to be amazing. And there are many people that simply, and again, I'm not saying this is anyone in the article, but there are a lot of people that get into the wine business who don't last more than those first couple years because they do not understand what the grind that we're experiencing right now is like. They simply don't. It's a lot of stress. It's a lot of lack of cash flow and making shit up as you go. And realistically, you're going to make a lot less money than you think you are. That's just how it is. There's a reason why and many of you have heard this cliche if you've been to Napa. It used to be, hey, if you want to make 10 million, if you want to make $1 million in the wine industry, start with 10. Now it's more like, hey, you want to make $1 million in the wine industry, start with 100. It's kind of how it is. This is this is an industry that will punch you in the gut over and over and over again, and you're just going to have to say, thank you, sir, may I have another, if you really want to survive. And even then, you still might not make it. Because being resilient's not enough. You have to have something that people want. And if you're someone like me who starts with Merlot and Riesling very foolishly because those are the varieties you want to make, but no one wants to buy them, I mean, what do you expect? The fact that like our brand, MTGA as a brand, doesn't make sense because of what we started with. We shouldn't exist today. But we found a way to adapt and learn and carve out a niche for ourselves and make really excellent wine with a great story that we hope is authentic to people, because it's the life I live, that we live out here. And that's what we want to share with people. This is how we do things. Come into our world and do it with us. This is what it is all about, is bringing people together and understanding what really goes into some of this stuff from like a craft winemaking perspective. We found our niche and it seems to be working. This year is going to be challenging. It's going to be rough. We are in the midst of tightening our belt, as one might say, in terms of expenses. Like, what can we do? Knowing that if something doesn't change and pretty quickly, this year's going to be really tough, you know? And for many people, it's tough this year. It was tougher last year. And you're going to see, very much like this article kind of suggests, you're going to see a lot of small wine businesses probably disappear. Now, there are a lot of things that people could, you know, blame that on. The right market conditions, not enough investment, you know, not enough support from sales teams. And I think this is an interesting analogy. And I'm going to paraphrase this here. I think it was Simon Sinek. For those that don't know who that is, you should look him up. Very interesting cat. His book, Start With Why, is an amazing read if you're into business, entrepreneurship, kind of stuff like that. Start With Why is a great book. And he provides the example of when the United States was trying to, you know, create manned flight back in the world. We all know the story of the Wright brothers and how they succeeded. What you might not know is that there was someone funded by the U.S. government, spent a lot of money on this guy to try and achieve the same thing. And he couldn't do it. With all the investment, all the support in this, what was a weird niche at the time, like, you're going to get people to fly? Like, what are you talking about? He had all the support that you could ever ask for, and he failed. Yet these two yahoos out in the field were able to make it happen. The best part about the story is that after the Wright brothers did that, and, you know, we realized, hey, we can make this kind of craft and people can fly. This is going to be wild. The gentleman who had, you know, all the support, you know, all of the finances, everything lined up for him, did he go to the Wright brothers and say, hey, I need to learn from you. You've done what I couldn't achieve. What is your secret? How can we work together? You know what he did instead? He quit. He quit. I don't know if that was because of ego. I mean, it had to be because of ego, let's be honest. But you had this niche that maybe people didn't think was possible at the time, that even someone with the best market conditions and all the support in the world still can fail. And then you have a couple of yahoos, you know, waiting in the wings, pun intended, that are just doing their best and end up achieving something that even that person could not. It's very akin to the wine industry, that even if you have the best investors, the best facilities, money kind of no object to make something happen, it can still fall flat on its face. And then you can be those of us who are the undercurrent. You're like, hey, let's see if we can throw some stuff at the wall and make it stick. You heard a Merlot, you heard a Riesling, let's see if we can do this thing. And for some reason it does. And for many reasons, it shouldn't have. But it did. So there are a lot of kind of extenuating circumstances around this article. You know, the finances, the farming, the styles of wine being made, the investments or lack thereof, and people just trying to make it happen. You know, just good old sweat equity. The reality for this wine revolution is that it's still on the horizon. It is not a mirage, but it is further off than we think it is. And the best thing I think that we can do as an industry is be vocal like this. Write articles like this that are thought-provoking. Whether you agree with some of the producers in the article or not, if they're trying to capture these weird niche segments of the wine industry and for some reason it's just not sticking yet, hopefully they have the wherewithal to last through this tough time and hopefully through the next one as well and continue doing something they're passionate about and share it with people that are equally as passionate about this beverage that we craft. They might not make it. We might not make it. That's the reality of being this entrepreneur, right? Like you have something that this is part of the risk, is that you're taking this on and it's going to be really tough to do, especially in this industry. I mean, every industry has its challenges. The capital investment into making wine is pretty nuts, and the return you actually get on that is pretty slim. But if you can get through these tough times, you're gonna have to fight, you're gonna have to scratch, you're gonna have to claw. There are gonna be moments where you're like, you know what? I can't pay off the credit card. We're just gonna do the minimum payment, and we're just gonna have to suck up the interest for a month until our wine club shipment gets here, because that's gonna be what we need financially to make this happen. You know, that's going to come around. There are going to be times where you're going to have to maybe decrease production, maybe not buy as many new barrels. You're going to have to not be able to. I mean, this is something we're looking at right now, as we wanted to buy some new equipment this year. We're probably not going to be able to. That's fine. We will be able to eventually. And that's the mindset you have to have, is you have to kind of go with these ebbs and flows. And hopefully, you have done enough to keep you going. You know, if you are a startup right now, you're in a tough spot. You're in a really tough spot. Things have only gotten more expensive in recent years, as we've described. You know, alcohol sales in general are down. Wine sales in general are down. Tourism is down. There's a lot stacked against you right now. If you can keep it going, keep it going, because it gets better. But you better have a plan. You better be evaluating every little thing that you do, every little dollar you spend, and understanding what the ROI on that is and if it's actually worth doing that anymore. Because you're going to have to probably cut some things. You're probably going to have to make some changes. And if you're going to put your head in the sand and be like, nope, this is how we do things, that's it. That's where that business fails. It's something keep in mind at all times, that the day you stop growing is the day you start dying. And that goes for life, for business, and you have to be able to roll with the punches and shrug them off. And sometimes you're not going to see that haymaker coming. But if you get knocked down, as Chumbawamba would say, you got to get back up again. All right. Man, that was a hell of a way to wrap that episode up. I'm so proud of myself. That was perfect. I was not going to reference Chumbawamba, but here we are. Hilarious. I can't believe that happened. Oh, sometimes you just love it when a plan comes together. I really hope all of you go and read this article. It's a really great read. It is very, very interesting to those of you that are probably interested in the nuts and bolts of wine and wine making and why it is tough to be in this industry. You know, how we can survive, and you know, realistically, you know, where this passion kind of comes from. Like, here's what we're trying to achieve. And, you know, we kind of have these best laid plans, and we are going to be these kind of starving artists to a certain extent. But if you've really done your homework, hopefully your financial outlook isn't too terrible, you can get through these times. Again, I don't know the finances of anyone that's in this article. But if they're anything like us, you know, they're seeing a down year. They might have seen, you know, a couple of down years back to back. And that's, you know, one down year is enough to sink a wine business, much less two. So if you're seeing that trend, what are you doing? How are you trying to remedy that? Are you hitting the road like we are? Are you trying to, you know, do more work with your distributors? Like, what kind of support are you giving your business? Or are you resting on your laurels? Are you saying, hey, we're this small direct brand. We are going to sit here and just wait for the phone call to ring. Or the phone call to ring, the phone to ring, whatever. That's, these are the, this is the stuff you got to consider, you know, when you're running a business. I'm so glad I don't have any investors. I love you all who have offered. Every once in a while, someone does. And I'm like, yeah, let me do you a favor. Don't. Just let us continue doing this because you're not going to see the return you think you're going to. If you're going to invest in a wine business, no offense to some of you out there that have, but you kind of have to be willing to not see that money ever again. Hopefully you get a decent return. Hopefully there are perks like, you know, regular shipments or events and other things, but this is a tough industry, big or small, to be invested in. And right now, more so than ever. It's just kind of the way this ebbs and flows as the industry goes on. But this wine revolution is not going anywhere. The undercurrent will always be there, especially with more mergers and acquisitions happening at the top level. There will always be room for the cream to rise to the top. And that's what all of us small guys are trying to do, plain and simple. Of course, I say I wrap that up really well with a Chumbawamba reference, and I just keep talking. Oh, I should have just stopped while I was ahead. Anyway, I appreciate you all tuning in. This is a little bit of a longer episode than, you know, we normally do. Try and keep it typically around like 40, 45 minutes. But this is a topic that is just permeating through the industry. Everybody is talking about this. And while this is something that you as a consumer might not see, this is where a lot of us are paying very close attention to what's going on. So definitely give this article a read. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm going to get out of here before I decide to keep talking. So please be sure to subscribe, like, review the podcast at MTGA Wines on all of our social networks. We are going to have a lot more on this topic coming down the pipeline. And man, it's going to be an interesting time over the next 8 months to see how things shake down the rest of this year and where 2025 starts off for. So have a great rest of the week. Thank you all so much out there for the amazing support that allow us to keep doing things like this show, like the wines that we make. Y'all are the best. Remember, it's okay to have your Tuesday night pizza wines you buy from the store, but if you really want something with some authenticity that is a craft product, it might be a little bit more expensive, but damn it, you're going to get the bang for your buck. I guarantee it. We'll catch you next time.